We have been in the middle of a workshop that Chris S. has been giving. Chris is currently doing the workshop through the first 164, and he's using the original manuscript. Last couple of weeks, he's probably around doctor's opinion, and he will continue on next week. Last week we had a couple of special speakers, friends of the group, and this week we also have a special speaker, a friend of the group. And this is someone that's been around for a while, has been part of this group in the early days when we just celebrated our 10th anniversary, and you said around 2000 started coming. So I will turn the meeting over to Robert.
Good evening, everyone. My name's Robert. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm also Chris. I'm an alcoholic also. I'll explain that a little bit later, but I was blessed with two first names. But I'm a little nervous. Bear with me. This is like a spiritual homecoming. Coming here. Last time I was here was in the spring of 2000, and I was in a whole world of, you know the word. Yeah, I have to apologize ahead of time. I'm working on my profanity, so if it slips out here and there, you just bear with me. But I was in a whole world of shit coming here, and because of my alcoholism and what I failed to do about my alcoholism. And you know, over the last 8 years or so, this place has been like a beacon of hope to me. And tonight is like, by coming back here, it's almost beyond words expressing how I'm feeling right now. I'm nervous, but I'm also very emotional because of the power that this place holds for me and a lot of the people that are here that I met 8 years ago. And, you know, the power of unconditional love that's contained within the rooms of AA that literally saved my life. And, you know, it is just such a joy to be here, and it's such a blessing that I made it to here tonight, not just by train and bus and all those wonderful things, but, I mean, spiritually and emotionally and mentally and physically. So the place to start is in the beginning, I guess. I was born in Westfield, New Jersey, middle class, no care in the world. At least so I thought growing up. What can I say? I'm an alcoholic. I had all the traits of an alcoholic: not fitting in, alone in a crowd, hated being lonely, but hated being around people. All the golden oldies. And, you know, I had a lot of other issues that were going on in my life. Some dealing with my sexuality. I wasn't born the right sex, apparently. And it took me many years to deal with that. And alcohol was the instant cure for that. It turned me into something that I wasn't. And it kept me that person for a long, long time. But it also brought me out of myself. And as you hear over and over and over again, it gave me the courage, it gave me the personality, it gave me the outgoingness, it gave me the self-confidence, it gave me absolutely everything I strive to be but couldn't find inside myself unless I poured alcohol inside me. I got drunk for the first time at 13 on Old Man Reeves Hill, and from the beginning, you know, it was drinking alcoholically. I drank alcoholically every day for effect, got drunk for 17 years. From the age of 18 to 35, successfully, mind you, at least so I thought. And, you know, I mean, I did all the things that you're supposed to do coming out of a town like Westfield, you know, go to college, get a job in the city, wear a suit and tie to work, go to graduate school, get my MBA, skyrocket through the corporate world, travel the world. You know, on the outside, I was a picture-perfect person, achieving absolutely everything that, you know, I always use this analogy, like, one of my favorite movies is The Man in the Gray Final Suit. Like, everything is supposed to be perfect, you know. And you know, it's this undercurrent of perfection that's driven into you in towns like Westfield. And I don't know whether I have resentments against Westfield or not, but I still was incomplete on the inside out, and I was an absolute mess on the inside out. And over the 17 years of daily drinking, I progressed, and at the time I was probably weighing about 150 pounds or so. And any normal person should know that if you're able to consume 2 and 3 six-packs of beer or a fifth of vodka, and you weigh 150 pounds and be able to go to sleep and not throw up, and, you know, that's just not quite normal. You know, I'll look at my sister and she'll have like 2 martinis and be throwing up for 2 days. But I guess I was comfortable with the fact that I was an alcoholic. My dad's an alcoholic. His father was an alcoholic. His father's father was an alcoholic. My grandfather died of the disease. My dad just stopped drinking one day. How he did it, I don't know. But usually people that finish a fifth of scotch a day aren't really able to just stop. But somehow he did. That definitely wasn't me. I knew I was an alcoholic from like age 18, and it's like I didn't even care. I almost thought it was like romantic. It was like a cool thing to do, you know. I was around people like me. I was in, you know, the smell of bars, the look of bars, the feel of bars. It was absolutely fantastic. But as my life progressed, I really stopped going to bars. I would go to bars to get the edge off, to stop the, you know, the shaking, and to the point where it was sliding because I couldn't even. And for about the last 10 years of my drinking, I was drinking about a fifth of vodka a day. And this was working my ass off for 12 hours, coming home at like 7, 8 o'clock, drinking a fifth of vodka, going to sleep at 12, and doing that every single day, every single day, every single day. And how I survived that, I don't know. They say alcoholics got livers of champions. Not everyone do, but by the grace of God, I don't have any liver damage. I don't know why. I don't need to know why. But my life rapidly started spinning out of control. 98, I got pulled aside by my boss. You know, I was on the partner track for working in management consulting. I was fantastic at what I was doing, you know, at least in my own mind. And I didn't think anybody knew what was going on in my life. And then out of the blue, the managing partner pulled me aside. He says, "You got a drinking problem." And it's the first time anyone ever, this was, I think I was 34, 35, confronted me about my drinking. And it was like a dam broke. It just burst out of me. Yes, absolutely, I got a problem with my drinking, because all of the bells and whistles were starting to come along with it. Absences, unexplained breaking of appendices, and all the lies that went around it, simply because I fell, because I was too drunk to walk, and making up incredible lies about stepping on my cat and how a table fell, and it was terrible, it was terrible, it was terrible, and all I did was fall down on a table, and, you know. But as a non-alcoholic, and as a friend of mine today, he was able to see my pattern and see that I had a problem with alcohol. And they sent me on up to the Carrier Clinic for a week, and I spent a week there and detoxed, and I was cured, and I went home, and I think I went to 2 meetings and stayed sober for about 3 months, and then made the brilliant move to move from Lawrenceville to Hoboken, which at least at some point in time had more bars per square mile than any other small city in the world, or some ridiculous fact like that. And needless to say, I think I lasted a day or two. And I spent about the next year sobering up for trips to my father's house down in North Carolina because he thought I was sober. And then just going on these incredible tears and then stopping, and then incredible tears and then stopping. And going to meetings but not getting plugged into AA, and learning all the things I need to say and all the shares that sounded really cool. Like, this guy really knows what he's talking about. This guy is like Mr. AA, and, you know, on the inside, I'm absolute freaking ball of jelly and a complete mess, and just holding my breath and waiting to gasp for air, and that air is alcohol. because I did absolutely nothing for my recovery other than going to AA. And you know, as I'm speaking tonight, I'm sharing about how what I've learned looking backwards through my successes and through my failures. And it's only through the past that I'm able to continue moving forward, because it's a constant reminder of where I was. And I think, you know, I mean, that's the basic of just about any meeting, you know, where you were and how you got to where you are today. And anyway, I'm coming to like the ultimate defining moment in my life. I'd come to a point where I couldn't even sleep anymore, and I was just drinking on a daily basis. And probably the worst enemy that I ever met, other than alcohol, was the concept of telecommuting and working from home, because I was working from home, and all I was doing was drinking and sitting by my laptop and pretending like I was working. And eventually it took about a month before that just completely destroyed me, where I ceased to function. So anyway, on in September of 99, I was on my way to, I decided to get in the car with a half pint of vodka for one last roadie for, you know, before you go to the detox. And I was on my way to Carrier Clinic, driving from Hoboken, and I'd gotten about 49 of the 50 miles, and at mile marker one left, I plowed head into an automobile that contained a counselor that worked at the Carrier Clinic, killing her instantly, and complete blackout. And I've dreamt about it twice. I don't remember any of it. And as far as I was concerned at that point in time, my life ceased to exist. I no longer existed. I no longer deserved to exist. I no longer deserved to walk the face of this earth. And how I'm alive today is God's grace. And, I mean, for a whole number of reasons. I never wear seatbelts. I wore a seatbelt. My car was infinitely worse. Anyway, they broke the news to me in Montgomery Police Station, and he's saying, you got a DWI and you got driving on the wrong side. And I'm thinking, please, please God, please God, please God. And he said, and you killed someone, and it was. It's like slow motion today, and that was a little over 7 years ago, almost 8 years ago. And I spent the next 15 months living pure hell. And for the first, like, from like September to February of 2000, I mean, I was going in and out of mental wards. I was going in and out of detoxes. I was going in and out of rehabs. You know, I mean, it was emergency squad was called twice. I learned that Ambien and a fifth of vodka don't mix very well. And, you know, I mean, I make light of this a little bit, because I can today, because I've lived through this, and you know, it helps me cope, and it helps me realize that it's not the end of the world. So I hope nobody thinks I'm like a, you know, some kind of ghoul if I joke about drinking Ambien and vodka, but that's, and the fact that it, you know, within a whisker of killing me, and that was on two separate occasions. But again, God's grace, I'm not dead. And I remember I spent 28 days in Sunrise House, and I thought I was starting to get a grip of it, and I hadn't invited God into my life yet, and I hadn't embraced any of the first three steps. And I got on the train in Lafayette and got off in Hoboken, still living in Hoboken, still not a good move. I didn't make it 5 minutes off the train with every intention in the world, with every reason in the world not to drink. You just killed someone because of alcohol. Because of my alcoholism, I just killed someone. And yet, I was without a defense against drinking, completely. And I look back on that today, and boy, if that isn't a definition of powerlessness, if that doesn't factor into me getting a real strong understanding of what powerless means to me and what alcohol and my powerlessness over alcohol means, then, you know, I don't know what I'm doing sitting up here. And I can say that today, but I couldn't say that at the time. Somehow, again, by God's grace, I ended up in this place that I don't even think exists anymore. It's Honesty House in, where is it, Gillette or Sterling or something like that. Anyway, I met all the crew, Charlie Stuckey and Bob Beiser, and God bless Bob Beiser. Mind you, all the legal wranglings was going around, and I had a 7 with an 85 sentence hanging over my head, which means I was going to do 6 years. And looking backwards, I could have taken a plea and probably gotten 5 years. But I look back, and for everything that's happened in my life, there's a reason for it. And the reason was getting from that journey, from getting pulled out of that car all the way through to today. And by meeting people, and by having things introduced to my life that has fundamentally, spiritually, emotionally changed my life and changed the way I think about life today. Anyway, I remember it was probably, this is going to sound real corny and all that, but it was like a really nice spring day, and it was like some meeting was coming in, and this gigantic flatbed truck came pulling in, and on the back it looked like a bunch of hillbillies that were riding in. And it was the commitment for the night. And I don't know whether it was associated with this group or not, but it was close, because a lot of the members were members here as well. And it was like a hoedown type meeting. And they come in, and they bum rushed the place, and they came in downstairs and started talking about this thing called AA. Really talking about this thing called AA, you know, in its most pure sense, as it's written in the big book, as it's instructed to follow in the big book, the cookbook, the instructions to get sober. And it started sinking in. And, I started getting close with some of the guys. We'd come to this meeting every once in a while. And I was a complete freaking mess. I had no idea. Fear, capital F-E-A-R, skinny white boys from Westfield don't go to prison. And I'm going to prison. And, you know, I mean, it's... I'm going to get killed. I'm going to get raped. But oddly enough, the most frightening thing about me was I was scared I was never going to come back who I was, which is true. But I was most scared about losing all the values that my parents taught inside of me. You know, the golden rules and all that good stuff that was buried, but in there. And I was real frightened that I was going to come out to be some cold, hard, angry, hating individual with no hope, with no faith, and that really scared the shit out of me. And I started getting close with Chris S., and I said, I need some help. I was one night here at a meeting, somewhere back there or down there, somewhere around there. He said, come on. And he said, you're not going to the meeting, you're coming downstairs with me. And I came downstairs. I'm like, what did I get myself into? And him and I think it was Dave the pilot, we figured out just a little while ago. I don't think he's around anymore here. I think Chris said he lives in Dallas. But they basically said, so you're an alcoholic? I said, yeah. They said, prove it. I said, well, I lasted less than 5 minutes coming out of a 28-day rehab and went right to the bar. He said, all right, that's a good start. I said, well, I killed someone in a car crash in a blackout. He said, that's, and I continued to drink afterwards. And they said, that's an even better start. Do you believe that you're powerless over alcohol? I said, absolutely. He said, can you get yourself out of the shit that you're in right now? Can you get yourself to have faith, to get your emotions under control, to get your mental state in order? I said, absolutely not. That's why I keep ending up on suicide watch in the mental ward, and why I keep ending up in rehabs and coming out and drinking in less than 5 minutes, and why I want to kill myself and why I don't deserve to live. Of course I can't deal with that myself. He says, do you believe somebody else can? Do you believe in a power greater than yourself? I said, I believe in God. He says, okay, you've completed the second step. He said, get down on your knees. I said, okay. And I got down on my knees with the three of us, or two of them and me, and we said the third step prayer. And here's where I get real emotional. Because that seed that was planted. And, you know, I wish I could say that everything was happy-go-lucky after that. It wasn't. But Chris proceeded to take me through the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth step over the next couple of weeks. And thank God he did, because I'm going away to prison. I don't know what my life is going to be like. But for the first time in my life, I understood what I was about on the inside out. And by doing I almost look at it as like triage. And I know today I gotta work through the steps. I gotta do another fourth step. I know I do. But it got me to understand the concept of what's my role in any given situation, what's my role in any feeling, what's my role in any emotion. And it got me to understand why I have resentments and what resentments are all about, and how resentments are just pure poison. And more importantly, and most importantly to my recovery today, it taught me about the word fear. And how fear is paramount to my understanding my fears, the thousand forms of fears, is paramount to my recovery. Because I never understood fear. I thought as something, you know, either you see in a scary movie or somebody coming at you with a knife. And by truly grasping the concept of fear and how it links to my emotions, I started my journey of self-knowledge and self-learning and self-growth and spiritual development. And I wish I could say everything was picture perfect, but in July of 2000, I split Honesty House, because that fear took me over, that fear of going to prison, that fear of never being with someone again. And I only learned this recently. I always thought it was just my fear of prison, but it was fear that I wasn't going to have sex in a long time. So I ran off to New York. And I was reading this crazy book about the history of punk rock, and it was glamorizing heroin use, and I've never done heroin in my life. And fear had again consumed me so much to the point where I went to New York with the sole intention of just cashing in. I was going to buy, I didn't even know how to, I was going to buy some heroin, I was going to shoot up, and I was going to die, and I checked into the Chelsea Hotel. But, I mean, it was like the thing to do, you know? I read this punk rock book, and they all seemed to be going to the Chelsea Hotel to die, and, you know, like any good alcoholic, I'm going to be glamorous in my death, you know, or so I thought. But again, my alcoholism got in the way. And I quickly went into another blackout, somewhere between Summit and New York. Anyway, this is the start of my spiritual story. Somehow, some way, I was wandering around the village in a complete blackout, and I ran into my ex-partner, who had no business being in there, literally bumped into him in a blackout. And he knew my whole story. You know, I learned this all afterwards, secondhand. I feel I've like spent a lot of my life reliving history through other people telling me what I did in my life. But anyway, this is supposedly how it went. I bumped into him, and somehow he got out of me staying. I was at the Chelsea Hotel. He took me to the Chelsea Hotel. somehow found Chris S.'s number in my pocket. And sure enough, the next morning, I don't even know, I think it was a Sunday, maybe a Saturday. It was a Sunday. The door comes busting in, and Chris comes in, and Mary Beth comes in, and T comes in, and they says, you're coming to Bernardsville. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? Get away from me. I'm here to die, man. I'm going to die. I'm going to end this. I'm going to not feel this shit anymore. And sure enough, they kidnapped me and took me to Pottersville. And I slept it off, and that was my last drink. That was July 9th, 2000. And that was the first time that I've actually seen God demonstrated in my life that he's got me. I never quite believed it. I believed in God, but I didn't believe in all this stuff that he's got me. And, you know, over the next seven or so years, there were these little spiritual stepping stones, which are people in my life that I met that geared me and guided me. I went to this place called Reflections up in Hackensack and was introduced to the patron saint of AA in Bergen County, Father McKenna, God rest his soul. And this is when I had my spiritual awakening in a diner in Dumont, New Jersey. And he just looked at me. He said, Chris. Actually, he said, Tiger. His words were, he always uses the words Tiger. He says, Tiger. And this is straight up drunken priest that grew up in Newark, you know. I mean, Tiger. You know, God loves you, and I love you, and you're going to be all right. And I don't know why, I don't know how, but I believed him. And it went from my head to my toes, and I believed him. And I stopped fighting. I stopped swimming against the tide. I surrendered. You know, you hear all the analogies of the director and the actor, or the, you know, the coach and the player. Or I started getting, at that point in time, after coming at getting dragged out of the city and almost dead again, and somehow, some way, ending up alive again, that I'm not in charge of my life. Somebody else is in charge of my life. And from that point on, although a very difficult journey, but between really getting an understanding and working, you know, doing a thorough, at least I thought at the time, fourth step as best I could, given the fact that fresh in my mind that I had just killed someone, and fresh in my mind I'm going to prison, but also, you know, fully embracing the spiritual aspects of this program, I was all right, you know, and I was scared to death, but I did it, and I made it, and I met Sister Karina while I was in prison, who taught me other aspects about my spirituality, and I met Father Schultz, and you know, all the while I'm getting these letters while I'm locked up. No, hi, how you doing? No, hope you're well. Hang in there, buddy. You know, and it's all Chris is sending me all this stuff. It's just these snippets of AA stuff and Emmett Fox stuff and stuff on acceptance and stuff on awareness and stuff on letting go and stuff on, I'm like, can you give me a little, hey, how you doing, buddy, or something, you know? And he did this almost like four or five times a day. Or sorry, a week. For a period of about 2.5 years. And this is what I mean by unconditional love of AA. Chris didn't know me other than just being an alcoholic and doing a fourth step or fifth step with him, right in his Cherokee in the back parking lot there. But he was fueling my spiritual growth by constantly feeding in the stuff that I needed to be hearing. And it's not easy working a program in prison. In fact, it's damn difficult. A, they see AA as a privilege and not a right, and they see it as a program and not a way of life. And I spent time in three different prisons. The last prison I was in was Bayside, and it was a penitentiary, and it was a real shitty place. They kill people down in Bayside, and they had like a 9-month waiting list to get into AA. And then you'd go for like 8 weeks, once a week, and then it was over and you get a certificate, you know, and it's like they just don't get it. And so I learned to have a lot of meetings sitting on my bunk with the big book and stuff that Chris sent me and stuff that other people sent me. And I really start, you know, really, really built my foundation and really built a strong connection. And everything was great, you know. But the closer I got to home, that conscious contact with God, that pipeline got narrower and narrower and narrower and narrower. And God wasn't done for me yet. I had this plan, my plan, my intentions of how I'm going to run the rest of my life. I became a hotshot jailhouse attorney. I was good at it. I smoked Marlboros the whole time while I was locked up. And I was going to become a paralegal and save the world. And I was going to come out of a halfway house and move right into an apartment. And I'm on my way doing it. I end up in this place called Port House in Newark. And it's part of Mothership Integrity, the mother of all therapeutic communities. And I'm about 2 weeks in the port. I'm about 2 months away from starting working, getting a job, starting my life over again, when all of a sudden I get called in the director's office, and he says, we got a problem. I'm like, oh, shit. He says, you're not supposed to be here. I'm like, oh. He said, don't worry, you're not going back to prison. I said, well, where am I going? He said, you're in the wrong place. I said, what do you mean I'm in the wrong place? He said, you're supposed to be across the park. And I'm fuming right now. I said, what the fuck is across the park? He says, Integrity House. I said, oh, no. And I'm kicking and screaming all the way there. So anyway, I did my little 6 months there. And just before I was supposed to, if nothing else, Integrity taught me to just put step on the brake and slow down. You know, I don't have the answers. But God had another trick, you know, along with switching me over just to Integrity House. About a week before I was supposed to leave, one of the directors there, Bob Frascati, came screaming out. He goes, Robert, God's speaking to you. I said, what are you talking about? He said, they got a job opening here. You'll be a manager of administration. I said, I can't be a manager of administration at a place like Integrity. I still got a state number. He says, no, you can. This is Integrity. We do whatever the hell we want to do at Integrity. So sure enough, I took a job, and first meeting I went to, I moved over to Port House. I had 6 more months to do. First meeting I went to was with the Department of Corrections at Talbot Hall, where I'd just come from. It's an assessment center. I worked for the president. I said, I can't go back there. I said, I'm still a state inmate. He said, just don't tell anyone. I said, what are you talking about? And this is the crazy world I live in right now. And again, this is my spiritual connection. God, I fully believe this. God put me there. God put me there, not to become a paralegal in some sleazy law firm, no offense if there's any lawyers in the audience, but taking my addiction, taking my experience, and taking the gifts that God gave me that I was good at in the business world and applying it, you know, and I've never been happier in my life. I can't figure it out. I'm making a quarter of what I used to, but it's not about the money. I work more hours than I did as a management consultant. It's not about that. It's about the biggest lesson that I learned in prison, and this ties directly into why we do service in AA, is by doing unto others, I get out of myself. And I did a lot, you know, I learned that while I was in prison. I mean, about people that can't read or people that can't put a sentence together or people that just, and by doing things for other people. I'm working towards this terrible beast of addiction and all the cashes and prizes that come with it, the criminality, the deaths, the murders, the overdoses, for a wonderful organization where it's an open book for me where I want to take this. And I mean, that is so freaking cool right now, you know. And it's all about you know, the spiritual fulfillment I have. And, you know, but it's not my recovery. A lot of people at work in integrity, they use integrity as a recovery. They see it, you know, somebody who's kicking a 10-bag-a-day habit, walking in the door just sick as hell, and that's all they need to stay sober. That's not all I needed. When I got out of Porthouse, I went into an Oxford house, the last place I wanted to be after living in group quarters for the last 7 years straight. Was living in a house with another bunch of guys, but I knew I had to because I knew I was I knew where I was coming from. I knew I had a whole new bucket full of resentments. I knew I was still an alcoholic. I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that I had to surround myself with sober people. I knew that I had to plug myself into AA again. I knew that I had to, you know, do all. I mean, I hadn't had a drink in 7 years or 6 years or something along those lines. But I knew I had to at least do 90 meetings in 90 days because I had to. I had to do that to stay sober because prison, excuse my language, prison fucks your mind up in many ways. And I'm still finding out after, you know, being out almost 14 months, 15 months. And I didn't want to take the chance of drinking again. So I spent about 6 months and a half in an Oxford house in Montclair. Montclair's got some great meetings. You know, there's more meetings in Montclair than there are in the city of Newark, which is a tragedy. And I got plugged in, and I got right back on, you know, on the horse, the AA horse. And I started developing my real program where I can choose to go to meetings. And it's funny. Now I live in Ironbound. I moved down to Newark. I figured I'm working with the city and I'm working with integrity, trying to, you know, save the world or save Newark and all that stuff. I might as well live in it. And I absolutely love it. And on the train right up here, I was thinking, you know, about how I run a perfect program, at least in my intentions, you know. If I followed all of my intentions, my program would be outstanding. But intentions are not action. And, you know, I'm here tonight by happenstance again, you know. I sent a Christmas card to Chris, you know, just for the hell of it. And then about 2 weeks ago, he sent me an email. I said, well, why don't you come speak here? I'm thinking, all right, sure. And he says, how's next week? I'm like, all right, fine. When I'm asked, I do. And my program today, on the 25 bus every morning, and at home when it's not during a weekday, I start my day off with the third step prayer every single day. Every single day. Because I need a daily reminder to start my day off that I'm my own worst enemy. That all of my difficulties are causing all of my difficulties, and that I need help to take away these difficulties. And each day's different. It's cool. You know, it's like identify the, like, you know, three or four or five difficulties of the day, you know, that I've been struggling with over the, you know, is it lust or is it arrogance or is it impatience? It's always my self-centeredness. It's always my selfishness. I was thinking, starting off today, I was going to say about, you know, like when you're going to speak, you want to say, you know, like really cool stuff, you know, especially in the Bernardsville group. And while we had that little moment there, I was thinking about, help me not say anything self-serving, because that's not what this is about. That's my ego talking, and my ego's an MF-er, you know. And my ego gets me in trouble, and my ego paints a picture of who I am that I really am not, and things I should be doing that I really shouldn't be doing, because I know. And that's why I say the third step prayer every morning. And if nothing else, that helps me on a daily basis with my program. I conclude the day on my knees, and I conclude the day thanking God for everything that he's given to me. First and foremost, my sobriety and my life. And I don't go to a meeting every day. I'd love to go to a meeting every day. I'm developing a new home group, the Barrow Mansion in Jersey City, which is a pretty cool group. I'm starting to go on commitments again. And what's funny is when the odd side of living in Newark is that I'm living amongst a lot of integrities. We call them student members because clients is so clinical and we're all about love. And I find like my Saturday morning ritual is always bumping into one or two or three. Sometimes they're drunk and sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're struggling, sometimes they're not. But that's another big part of my program is to work with as many other alcoholics as I can. And again, that's the selflessness that this program is about. About helping someone else find that beacon of light, of hope, of faith that other people have helped me find by sharing the message. And one of the greatest gifts also I learned while I was locked up was the whole concept of acceptance. And Chris, I think you sent about 300 different things on acceptance. And I was at a meeting a couple Saturdays ago, and this guy put it so eloquently and so simply. You know, you always hear, well, I got to accept the fact this is, I'm in the here and I'm in the now. I'm today, you know, this is what it's all about. You know, this is where God put me. That's acceptance. And this guy put it, he says, what's the word to accept something? When you accept something, you receive something. And the way he put it, he says, when I think of acceptance, I think of accepting a gift. And I was like, wow. And I started going over all the gifts that are in my life today. My life, that's a gift. I shouldn't be alive right now. I should not be alive right now. Not only for suicidally drinking for 17 years, not only for the car wreck, not only for these alcoholically passive reach out for help suicide attempts that I've come to learn are commonplace because people that seek and receive help still have an ember of life burning inside them. And I learned that today by looking backwards, you know. Or the gifts of employment or of where I am at 15 months coming out of prison. On a daily basis, I walk down Broad Street in Newark. I mean, and integrity is in the hood. I mean, it is straight up in the hood. The paper guy across the street's dealing heroin. The bloods around the corner are dealing crack and heroin. There's drive-bys usually once a month within a two-block radius. And these are usually filled with so many people without hope and so many of them that are coming out of prison without anything to cling on to. And, you know, with the Department of Corrections not providing something that's free readily, you know, because of security issues. And having the gift of AA in my life is unbelievable. It's a newfound freedom. You know, I measure my life today by the promises. You know, usually I look at the promises as, see, I'm like a business process guy, management consultant. I need structure and methodologies and charts and all this stuff, and I need metrics. You know, and the promises are metrics for me. You know. Has God been doing things for me that I couldn't do for myself? I'm sitting right here tonight. He sure is, you know. Has that feeling of uselessness and self-pity gone away? Not completely. I'm an alcoholic, you know. That's why I need AA, you know. And the beauty of where I'm at in my program today is I know I really understand myself. I understand loneliness. and how it makes me feel and how it causes me to do other actions that may not be the most sober actions in the world. But I can connect the dots between the feelings and the actions, and I also am learning to put different actions in that are more positive, you know. And I understand the concept of fear. I'm scared to death of the future right now. I'm scared to death that I'm not going to have a retirement account, you know, which my lawyer's driving around in. I'm scared to death of living check to check at 65. All of these financial insecurities. And all of these new feelings that are arising in me today are telling me that I need to go back to the steps. And I learned a couple weeks ago they're doing a step workshop, which is I confirmed is a derivative of a lot of the work that's come out of here with Barefoot Bill and in Hoboken. And I'm going to plug my ass right back in there again. And because I need to, because I know I got a whole backpack full of resentments I got to get rid of. And what's beautiful by doing an eighth step before I went away to prison is you got a lot of time in prison, you know. And I made a lot of amends through letters, of amends that people most normally wrote back and said, you don't owe me an apology. Just come out alive. Just come out whole and don't drink again. And that's your amends. You know, all these family members that spent their entire lives of raising up the Parkinson name. Excuse me for using my last name, but it doesn't matter. I was all over the front page of every newspaper after that crash anyway. So as I was talking before the meeting, my anonymity was broken a long time ago. Thinking that I destroyed the reputation of members of my family. That's such a bunch of BS, you know. But in my own mind, it was an embarrassment that I had to take care of so I could face them again on two feet. And I took care of a whole bunch of resentments, but I got a whole lot more to do, and new ones too, you know. And, you know, you hear this all the time. It's a process. It is a process. And it's a process that stops the moment I stop taking action in my recovery and stop addressing it on a daily basis. And if nothing else, and I'm not suggesting this as a course of action, you know, I go to about three meetings a week, two meetings a week. I'd like to go to more, but my fear's got me dealing with another ism, the workaholism, and we'll get there. You know, I'd rather be a workaholic right now than an active alcoholic, and I'll get there. Probably, you know, right about before I'm going to die, but, you know, but that's the process, you know. And I'm gonna close with something that Father McKenna gave me. And that man, he started the recovery mass up in Closter. An incredible spiritual event that still goes on every month. And that man made it up to about a month before I was released and died of brain cancer, and that really, really crushed me. But he said, actually, I'm going to leave with two things. He said, Tiger, why, he said, if you ever lose sight of your spirituality, if you go into the religious scripts and texts, a lot of times it talks about the back of God. He says, look backwards and look at all the different places that you've made it through and all the different situations and all the different really annoying situations that came into your life that nudged your life just a little bit or a little bit or put you in touch with the right person at the right time when I absolutely positively need it. He says, that's going to fuel your spirituality. And that's going to keep you going to the next day. And the last thing I'm going to close with is, I said, Father McKenna, how do I ever make amends for killing someone? And he looked at me, as you can tell, Tiger is his favorite endearing word. He said, Tiger, when it comes to you, you're going to know it. This guy talking about, and this was back in 2000, and This past winter, I was walking home from the bus stop in Montclair, and I don't know why, but this came into my mind, and it was like a movie, you know, like an echo chamber, you know, like, tiger, 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 when you know it, it will appear. And I'm like, where the fuck did this come from? And a light went on, and I looked at the life that I'm living right now and where I'm working and what I'm doing, which is completely polar opposite of where I thought I was going to be, where I wanted to be, where I knew I was supposed to be. And I said, holy shit. You son of a gun, man. And I realized that you know, what I'm doing today is an amends that I can make, you know, to Rosalind Feinstein. The woman's name that I killed. And I know I got to make other amends to that. I can't because of parole stipulations. But I will. And my biggest amends is to stay sober and, you know, to help another alcoholic achieve sobriety. I mean, that's the bottom line today. And that's the gift that this program has given to me. And I hope I was able to share a message of hope and faith and recovery, and hopefully it was rooted enough in the history of AA for this group. This is a tough group, but I had great teachers. And again, this place is a beacon of hope, and these rooms, you know, are just so full of unconditional love, of one alcoholic helping another. And I'm here today and I'm alive today because of that unconditional love of one alcoholic helping another. And that's what it's all about, you know. We're not perfect, and that's why we have each other. And, you know, I thank God for the opportunity to share tonight, and hopefully I brought you a good message. But thank you for letting me share.